Welcome back. Let's start by updating this hour's top stories. Japan's defense minister Shinjiro Koizumi pushes back against accusations of Tokyo's so-called new militarism. In a veiled swipe at Beijing, he describes the allegations as unfounded, urging for greater dialogue between the two countries. And Mr. Koizumi's remarks at the Shangri-La dialogue come a day after U.S. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth reaffirmed Washington's commitment to the Indo-Pacific and warned against any country dominating the region. China's envoy says his comments were more measured compared to last year. All eyes on whether U.S. President Donald Trump will accept the latest proposal to end the war in Iran. Reports suggest he remains firm on key U.S. demands, while Tehran accuses Washington of betraying diplomacy and making excessive demands. And the fight against Ebola is intensifying as the WHO chief Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus visits the epicenter of the outbreak to coordinate containment efforts. He says solidarity is the best immunity. And four more people who are trapped in a cave in Laos emerge after days of rescue efforts. Attention is now focused on finding the two remaining missing villagers as authorities weigh their next steps in the operation. We start with a recap of our top story this hour. Japan's defense minister Shinjiro Koizumi has dismissed allegations of Tokyo's so-called new militarism. Speaking at the Shangri-La Dialogue here in Singapore, he says what's needed is candid dialogue rather than the repetition of what he described as false claims. And Joe Bo, an expert from the Center for International Security and Strategy at Tsinghua University, said Mr. Koizumi's speech signaled it's unlikely that China and Japan would see a de-escalation in ties in the near future.
We believe Japan is making a dangerous move. Japan certainly is no longer what it was, but as to who can stop that, that is the question. I think only Japanese people can stop that, because whenever this kind of thing happens, you would always see a lot of protests in the streets of Japan. So eventually, it is in Japanese people's own interest to decide where this country is heading for.
And CNA's Tan Chu-hui has more on what the Japanese defense minister had to say.
Mr. Koizumi talked about the severe reality that's confronting the region today, the weaponization of everything, he said, threats to the international order and unilateral changes to the status quo by force or coercion. He said, you know, he was sad that he could not meet with his Chinese counterpart, Dong Jun, but said that Japan wants dialogue and that the door is always open. But still, he made a pointed jab at China, although he was careful not to name many names.
Think about it. There is a country that has a huge arsenal of nuclear weapons and strategic bombers. Japan has neither of such weapons, and yet Japan is labeled new militarism. Isn't it strange?
My colleague Chui also spoke on how Mr. Koizumi acknowledged Japan is strengthening its military capabilities.
Mr. Koizumi did say also that its status as a peace-loving country and that track record is recognized by the international community. But in the face of all the challenges today, what's at stake today is crucial, he said, and that is the freedom of every country to make its own choices. He referenced the Strait of Hormuz crisis, you know, sea lanes, the international order being neither free nor open, and also the new challenges that come from AI, unmanned systems, and cyber, in space, and these new ways of warfare spreading across the world. So it's only natural, he said, that every country is working to update its own defense capabilities to respond. He talked about his Prime Minister Sanae Takaichi's upgraded vision for a free and open Indo-Pacific. And he said that this vision, however, requires sustained action, not just thinking alone. He said that Japan will be more proactive in the region with joint training, with defense equipment and technology cooperation, and with information sharing. And he said that it was particularly about consolidating efforts, about connecting the dots to join lines and the lines to form planes. But he gave his allies the reassurance that Japan will do all this with full transparency.
We will do so in order to defend our nation and contribute to peace and stability of a free and open region. And Japan will carry out this update with a high degree of transparency. What are we developing these capabilities for? And based on what thinking, Japan will move forward while making a clear explanation to the international community.
Japan's defense chief was also very careful to say that these efforts are not directed at any particular country, but for the region's stability.
For more on China's perspective, Dawei, director at the Center for International Security and Strategy at Tsinghua University, weighed in on what Japan could do to ease tensions with China.
I think easing the tension is possible, but solving the tension is almost, I'll say, very, very difficult. I think it's impossible. The reason is that this China-Japan tension is, I will say, this is kind of structural change because Japan is rising. Japan wants to build its country as a normal country, or full-fledged military and political power, which China opposed because according to the peace constitution after the World War II, we don't think Japan should do that, and particularly before it reached any, you know, real meaningful reconciliation with its neighbors, China, Korea. So this, you know, rising of Japan and you know, raised the concern in China, and of course at the same time China's rise also raised concern in Japan. So it's hard to solve, but I do think it's in both country and in the region's interest to ease the tension a little bit. My personal view is that in November, China will hold the APEC summit in Shenzhen. There will be a chance that Prime Minister Takaichi may go to Shenzhen, and at least that summit will bring an opportunity for the two sides to talk and to ease the tension. But before the two leaders have meaningful discussion or try to easing the tension, I think the Japanese side need to do something or say something to clarify their position. I think because the origin of this round of tension was from Prime Minister Takaichi's speech in the Japanese parliament, so she probably need to clarify and also withdraw what she has said, and that will lay the foundation for the easing of the tension.
U.S. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth gave a keynote address at the forum yesterday, seeking to reassure Indo-Pacific allies that Washington remains committed to regional security. But Mr. Hegseth noted continuing concerns over China's military buildup and expanding presence across the region. He urged Asian partners to invest more in their own security capabilities rather than relying solely on American military power. His remarks were seen as striking a more measured tone at the Shangri-La dialogue.
The era of the United States subsidizing the defense of wealthy nations is over. We need partners, not protectorates. We seek alliances built on shared responsibility, not dependency. This is the maturation of our alliances in a new era.
Mr. Hegseth praised efforts by regional allies to strengthen their military capabilities. He singled out South Korea as a model of greater self-reliance in defense, describing Seoul's efforts as a breath of fresh air.
Alliances only work when they are true partnerships. It is a two-way street. You don't have a strong alliance unless everyone has skin in the game. No freeloading. History is not over. Alliances are not judged by the number of flags, but by the number of formations.
In response, China called Mr. Hegseth's remarks measured and restrained compared to last year, saying the recent Trump-Xi summit had laid the groundwork for a more stable and constructive relationship between Washington and Beijing. Mr. Hegseth also stressed the importance of maintaining dialogue between Washington and Beijing to avoid miscalculations that could heighten tensions between the two superpowers. Now on to the question of Taiwan. Mr. Hegseth said Any future arms sales would ultimately be determined by President Trump. And CNA's senior correspondent, Leon Whitekit, tells us how ASEAN members are reacting to Secretary Hegseth's call for Asian allies to increase their defense spending.
One analyst I spoke to said his biggest takeaway is that if you want U.S. protection, you must pay. That said, many analysts say that the nature of defense partnerships is transactional, not just under Trump, but also under administrations of Joe Biden and Barack Obama. The only difference is that Mr. Trump chooses to take up this transactional nature at the forefront. Now, other analysts say that what's missing, though, is the goodwill among these parties. Another defense analyst I spoke to said that 3.5% defense spending is actually quite unattainable, given that many of ASEAN countries cannot hit that target. He said there could be loopholes, such as categorizing certain infrastructure projects as defense projects. But one diplomat said that Asia is in good shape. Pete Hegseth had singled out several Asian countries, commending them for their what they've done to protect regional stability. And of course, those countries include Singapore, Malaysia, Indonesia, Thailand, as well as Vietnam and the Philippines.
It's time for one short break, but ahead on Asia Now. The AUKUS alliance announces plans to put AI-guided unmanned submarines into the hands of troops by next year.
Over the past 30 years, the fishing industry has come smack up against the limits of the planet.
Many populations really collapsed or close to collapse.
Friendship is an essential, wonderful part of being a human being.
Go out, say hello to people, smile at them, try to have conversations with people.
Instagram teen accounts. Automatic protections for teenagers with built-in content settings and contact limits, so teenagers only get messages from people they know, not strangers. Instagram teen accounts with automatic protections.
Right in a chaotic moment.
Midnight, later tonight here in Thailand, it's too little too late.
And I ask whether there's a political element to it, nobody can exactly tell you why.
Look, things are never perfect when you're engaged in politics.
Each one doing what each one wants.
So what's the United Nations doing amidst this world of supreme chaos?
We're pushing for answers every night on Asia Tonight.
Top defense officials of the Australia-UK-US grouping, also known as AUKUS, have announced at the Shangri-La Dialogue their joint project to develop unmanned undersea vehicles. The announcement comes under the group's Pillar 2 of the Defense Pact, which is to develop advanced defense technology, which includes quantum computing and AI. The group says it plans to put these uncrewed underwater vehicles into the hands of warfighters as early as next year.
The signature project will deliver a suite of highly adaptable, multi-mission UUV payloads designed to support undersea operations and maintain our collective advantage in the maritime domain. The United States, as we've said from the beginning, and we think the review we undertook only strengthened this partnership, remains committed to the AUKUS partnership and is moving as quickly as possible to enhance our combined submarine presence in the Pacific region.
And 17 countries from around the world will work together to protect critical underwater infrastructures, such as pipelines and cables. Singapore's defense minister, Chan Chun Sing, says such systems are key for connectivity, economic growth, and way of life. It's the first such inter-regional security framework that addresses undersea security challenges. And Sabrina Ng has more from the Shangri-La Dialogue in Singapore.
Now, since 2023, more than 10 of these cables underwater have been severed or damaged out at the Baltic Sea. And this has prompted NATO to actually step up surveillance of the region and to step up regional vigilance into surveying these areas out at sea. And of course, we know that this has become more and more pertinent in an era of increasing conflict around the world. We are realizing how much these energy infrastructures are important to the stability of the world. For regionally at ASEAN here, we have somewhat of a similar framework to bolster the resilience of COIs, but this one is different as it involves more than 17 countries around the world, across EU, across the Baltic Nordic nations, across Oceania, and of course ASEAN itself, to really come together to share the best practices, the best technical know-hows, and exchange the knowledge on how to bolster the security of these critical underwater infrastructures.
We may not have all the answers, but we certainly want to work on these issues together to see how we can establish those international norms to build those infrastructures, maintain those infrastructures, and even to protect those infrastructures, taking to task those may mean harm to our infrastructure and our way of life.
Now, this framework is not legally binding and has no financial binding legislations either. But what it does involve is the high-level exchange of technical know-how, of capability know-how from not just regional partners, but international partners as well. Earlier today, we also heard from Singapore Defence Minister Chan Chun Sing. He thanked the other 16 foreign ministers who took part of this framework. And he also urged for more countries to step forward and join this framework, you know, with hopes that this framework could eventually catalyze a larger conversation and more exchanges around the world about how to better protect COIs.
And defense leaders at the Shangri-La Dialogue have underscored the need to be credible partners in security cooperation, including the need to sustain political commitment while also strengthening domestic support. These talks took place at a roundtable session hosted by Singapore's defense minister yesterday. Alif Amshar has the details.
With a multi-day event in full swing, it was a packed day for Singapore Defence Minister Chan Chun Sing, who was involved in a flurry of engagements and discussions with other top defence leaders from all around the world. Among the key highlights, Mr. Chan hosted 31 ministers and their representatives to a roundtable discussion. The leaders reaffirmed the crucial need of continued strategic dialogue and keeping communication channels open to reduce the risk of misinterpretation and misunderstanding.
It was a very open and dynamic discussion. So some of the topics that we cover include, for example, how do we secure public support and political commitment for the long-term investment in defense necessary? And when we talk about long-term investment, it's not just about the budget commitment, but it's also about committing good people to serve in the defense sector and how we build up our industrial capacity over the long term.
Mr. Chan also engaged in a series of bilateral meetings. In discussions with his Malaysian counterpart, Khalid Nordin, both sides explored ways to further enhance mutual trust and understanding. Mr. Chan also met French Minister for the Armed Forces and Veterans, Catherine Vautrin, where both sides agreed to deepen defence training and tech cooperation. Meanwhile, Singapore and Italy will also strengthen the defence supply chains against unforeseen disruptions. The arrangement was concluded ahead of talks between Minister Chan and his Italian counterpart Guido Crosetto. Earlier in the morning, defence leaders from 8 ASEAN member nations also met at a breakfast meeting. It was co-hosted by Minister Chan and his Philippine counterpart Gilberto Teodoro Jr.
We discussed how we need to make sure that we keep our region open, free, accessible and secure. This not just about the shipping lanes, but also about the airways, so that we can continue to retain our reputation as an attractive investment location for us to get those investments and create good and better jobs for our people.
Minister Chan adds that there were also exchanges on non-conventional security threats, which he says often overlap with conventional ones. Describing the session as very useful, Mr. Chan says that all the ministers who were involved also expressed hope that it will take place every year at the sidelines of the Shangri-La Dialogue.
On the sidelines of the Shangri-La dialogue, Singapore Prime Minister Lawrence Wong also met with the U.S. Senate and a U.S. House congressional delegation. The countries reaffirmed their robust and substantive partnership, with both sides looking to grow their partnership in areas like energy and frontier technology. Prime Minister Wong adds that there's strong bipartisan support for the U.S. to continue engaging in the region. Qatar's Deputy Prime Minister also called on Mr. Wong. They discussed deepening cooperation in areas such as defense and energy security. Prime Minister Wong thanked Qatar for promoting regional stability and facilitating dialogue in the Middle East. Meanwhile, Singapore Defense Minister Chan Chun Sing reaffirmed defense ties with his counterparts from the Philippines, New Zealand, and Brunei. Now, they discussed cooperation at regional platforms such as the ASEAN Defense Ministers Meeting Plus. Mr. Chan marked 50 years of defense ties with Brunei and discussed cooperation in areas like critical underwater infrastructure security. He also met defense leaders from Lithuania, the Czech Republic, Switzerland, the UK, and a congressional delegation from the United States. And you can find more on the Shangri-La Dialogue on our website, cne.asia, and our mobile app, including this article on a special address by Timor-Leste's president, saying ASEAN holds lessons where world leaders have failed to uphold global order. Time for another quick short break, but ahead on Asia Now. The race to contain Ebola, the WHO chief is on the ground at the epicenter of the deadly outbreak in the Democratic Republic of Congo.
Recognized among the world's best, CNA takes home 22 awards at the World Media Festivals 2026. Recognized, trusted by audiences. CNA. Understand Asia. Journey across Asia through stories of change, resilience, and rediscovery this June on CNA. As countries across Asia race towards cleaner energy, communities are rethinking how they power their everyday lives. From solar fields to offshore wind farms, witness the transition towards a more sustainable future. In Power to the People, hikikomori, a growing phenomenon of social withdrawal, is now affecting youths in Singapore.
They always hide under the bed, doesn't want to go to school.
Follow four individuals over 6 months as families search for answers and possible solutions in shutdown. And as Singapore transformed over the past two centuries, so too did its rivers and waterways.
Before Raffles came to Singapore, it was once a wet rice paddy field.
Rediscover the water channels that once shaped the island in Lost Rivers this June on CNA.
My grandpa was the first one who came to Hong Kong.
I'm from Nepal and I live in Lisbon for many years now.
I feel that Thai people see me as a part of London. Sawadee
Tengo es que puedo coger lo bueno de la cultura china y quedármelo, y lo bueno de la cultura española y quedármelo.
I can't do anything because I stay in India 10 years.
I'm BT.
I'm proud of being Filipina and at the same time I'm proud of what I achieved here in Barcelona.
지금은 인도에서 거의 가족처럼 함께하고 있습니다.
남이 많은가?
Things can coexist together, and that's the beauty of Hong Kong as well.
When I leave to the Chennai, I feel like, oh God, I'm home.
The new locals.
Season 2 on demand at cna.asia.
The United States warns it's more capable than of resuming its war with Iran. That is after President Donald Trump said any peace deal must adhere to his red lines. That means Tehran never being able to develop nuclear weapons. And Mr. Trump held a meeting with top aides on Iran's latest effort to end the war, but it concluded without any firm decision. And Iran's advisor to the Supreme Leader accused Washington of betraying diplomacy by making what he called excessive demands. And Iranian media had said a draft of its proposed memorandum of understanding with the U.S. included an agreement to release $12 billion U.S. dollars in frozen Iranian assets. And amid the limbo in resolving the crisis, the U.S. military said it fired a missile at a Gambia-flagged vessel to stop it from sailing to an Iranian port. And the move marked the fifth commercial vessel the U.S. has disabled as it enforces a blockade around Iran's maritime borders. On the Iranian side, state media said its air defenses shot down a drone belonging to what it called U.S.-Israel aggressors yesterday. The troubles come as Israel continues to push deeper into Lebanon, all in a bid to cripple Hezbollah. Reports say the IDF has now penetrated further north, beyond the original line, which roughly follows the Litani River. Lebanon has slammed the IDF's alleged scorched earth operations, calling it to stop. And Iran had insisted on ending hostilities in Lebanon as part of any deal to end the war. But Israel maintains it has the right to defend itself, including ridding Hezbollah as a threat. The head of the World Health Organization is in Bunia, the eastern city of the Democratic Republic of Congo. And that's where a rare strain of Ebola continues to spread at a speed faster than the response. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus stressed an all-out community effort is needed, saying solidarity is the best immunity against the illness.
We are working under the leadership of the government, and many partners are involved. So aligning our messages is important. So that needs coordination based on science, based on evidence, based on data. We should say this is what's happening, and that will be addressed and can be addressed if there is good coordination among partners.
Mr. Ghebreyesus is in the country to coordinate the UN Health Agency's efforts as infections rise with no known treatment for the Bundibugyo strain. More aid has arrived from donors around the world. That includes the EU and U.S., but health workers are facing resistance from residents over strict medical protocols for handling victims' bodies, which has led to several clashes over burial rights. And conflict in some outbreak zones is also impeding access to medical help for some victims, making the extent of the outbreak unknown. So far, more than 240 suspected deaths have been reported in the DRC, with suspected cases climbing past 1,000. Neighboring Uganda has also reported more confirmed infections, raising the number to 9. Over in Sao Paulo, Brazil, authorities have also isolated a man who traveled from the DRC and is now showing symptoms of the illness. Now, if confirmed, he will become the first case of Ebola outside Africa as part of the latest outbreak. Switching gears to news in Laos, 5 villagers have now been rescued from a flooded cave. That is after 4 more trapped survivors were safely brought out by rescuers on Saturday. Reports say they walked out on their own before rescuers even re-entered the cave. And their escape came a day after rescuers guided the first survivor to safety. But the operation is not over yet. 2 other villagers remain missing. Rescuers believe they entered the cave separately and maybe in a different section of the underground network. Diving teams are assessing conditions and planning the next phase of the search. Crews are trying to move pumping equipment deeper into the cave to remove more water before attempting to reach the missing pair. Search teams are also exploring another side of the mountain, looking for entrances into the underground network. And local residents have reported hearing voices from an area believed to be near the missing villagers. As parrots grow in popularity as pets here in Singapore, authorities are discouraging owners from letting their birds fly freely outdoors. The Animal and Veterinary Service has put out an advisory highlighting the risks involved. But at least one interest group says the guidance is unlikely to stop enthusiasts from letting their birds take flight. Eugene Chow with this report.
One, two, go!
Letting pet parrots soar freely outdoors might seem natural for most owners. But authorities say this practice comes with risks in urban Singapore. For instance, such birds may disturb passers-by or contract diseases from wild animals.
There is a risk for the parrots to fly, be disoriented, as well as not coming back to where their owners are. So this advisory will help owners understand the risks of parrot-free flying, which requires a lot of advanced skill training, and also apprise them of the risks involved in such an activity.
The advisory was launched at the first event for parrot care in Singapore, which was attended by over 400 people and close to 100 birds. Parrot Society Singapore also put out a revised handbook on responsible care for the colourful birds. The group says the practice of free flying does benefit some parrots, especially larger ones.
If you understand how parrots live in the wild, they actually live in vast spaces. So they do fly many miles per day, many kilometers per day. So they do need that kind of level of exercise to replicate how they live in the wild.
One free-flying community says it will continue holding sessions 2 to 3 times a week. It adds that while eagles can sometimes give chase, parrots have a strong natural instinct to dodge and avoid attacks.
Most of our parrots here, I would say 100%, they are all being well-trained before they are out of free-flying. So, and parrots does not attack any people walking around there unnecessarily. Because they are all well-trained, and we are actually trained on recall basis, meaning the birds will actually fly back to us.
Mr. Lim says parrot owners should take extra precautions when letting their pets fly free. This includes putting GPS trackers on the birds and sending them for regular health checks.
And let's stay in news here in Singapore, where there's now a new institute to deepen research in artificial intelligence, business, finance, and society. It's known as GIFS. The Nanyang Technological University Institute aims to bridge cooperation between academia, industry, and government. It will study how AI and other emerging tech are changing economies, businesses, and society while identifying the opportunities and risks that come with these rapid developments. The launch is part of NTU Nanyang Business School's 30th anniversary celebrations. And one of the institute's projects is exploring next-gen virtual simulations of economies, markets, organizations, and digital ecosystems. And another will focus on training AI models and agents for advanced research in areas such as economics, finance, accounting, and information systems. NTU says this aims to strengthen Singapore's position as a trusted, sound, and progressive financial hub.
There will be academic outputs, there will be conferences that bring researchers from different fields together. We are very much interested in collaborating with the industry to incubate certain projects to the extent that they can be commercialized or offered as a social public goods for the society.
As AI monitors more transactions and behaviors in real time, accountability and fairness matter even more. Automated decisions must be explainable and open to challenge. And there must always be a clear line of accountability behind every AI-driven decision. And that means a person, a process, or an institution that owns the decision.
We'll go for a short break, but ahead on Asia Now, we'll continue our coverage of Asia's premier security conference, where Singapore's defense minister will share his thoughts on evolving security partnerships in the last plenary session of this year's Shangri-La Dialogue.
CNA wins big at the New York Festivals 2026 with an outstanding haul of 16 awards, including 11 gold, 2 silver, and 3 bronze. Recognized on the global stage for trusted news, excellence in journalism, and compelling documentaries. CNA, understand Asia.
CNA's app and website just dropped a new feature. Games. Easy to play and great for quick breaks on a busy day. We have 5 games. Here's Buzzword, where you form as many words as you can using the given letters. All words have to include the center letter. Make it extra fun by inviting a friend to a challenge. Over at Guessword, you have 6 chances to uncover the hidden word, using the color feedback to see if you place the letters correctly. In Mini Crossword and Mini Sudoku, challenge yourself by completing them in the shortest time possible. Feeling stuck? You can always play with a friend or ask for help. We also have an all-time favorite, Word Search. There's only one rule: drag from the first to the last letter in any direction, including backwards and diagonally. Here's the fun part. When you sign in, you can build streaks when you play daily, earn badges, and even if you miss a day, you can use a freeze to save your streak. Have fun!
In Singapore and across the region, every story starts on the ground.
So we're expecting a high stakes world that's seeing the global economic world.
From policy to business, we help you understand the changes and their impact.
Welcome back. We're going to be talking about the Shangri-La Dialogue 2026 with U.S. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth giving a keynote address at the forum yesterday, where he sought to reassure Indo-Pacific allies that Washington remains committed to regional security. But Mr. Hegseth noted continuing concerns over China's military buildup and expanding presence across the region. He urged Asian partners to invest more in their own security capabilities rather than rely solely on American military power. His remarks were seen as striking a more measured tone at the Shangri-La Dialogue.
The era of the United States subsidizing the defense of wealthy nations is over. We need partners, not protectorates. We seek alliances built on shared responsibility, not dependency. This is the maturation of our alliances in a new era.
Mr. Hegseth praised efforts by regional allies to strengthen their military capabilities, singling out South Korea as a model of greater self-reliance in defense, describing Seoul's efforts as a breath of fresh air.
Alliances only work when they are true partnerships. It is a two-way street. You don't have a strong alliance unless everyone has skin in the game. No freeloading. History is not over. Alliances are not judged by the number of flags, but by the number of formations.
But we can speak softly while carrying that big stick and be very clear. And we will soon go to the Shangri-La Dialogue in Singapore, where Singapore's Defense Minister Chan Chun Sing is set to speak at a session shortly. And this will mark the 6th plenary session, so let's listen in.
Of the Shangri-La Dialogue. For over 2 decades, the SLD has provided a valuable opportunity for leaders to speak frankly, listen carefully, and find practical ways to work together to overcome our challenges. It is also an opportunity for us to create new possibilities. And this matters even more today as we meet at a time of heightened instability. Having heard your views over the last few days, I would like to share Singapore's perspective on how the nature of conflict is evolving, how we need to adapt, and what must remain constant. Conflict has evolved in terms of the three beyonds: beyond geography, beyond military firepower, and beyond the here and now. First, beyond geography. Conflict is no longer geographically isolated. Today, we are hyper-connected across borders and across military, economic, information, and cyber domains. Conflicts in Eastern Europe and the Middle East, for example, have disrupted global supply and production chains far beyond those regions. Second, beyond military power. While conventional military conflicts were previously largely defined by military capabilities, today's conflicts reflect the interplay of multiple dimensions of power, from weaponizing economic leverage to contesting narratives to waging lawfare to shape global rules and norms. Third, beyond the here and now. Conflicts are no longer just about yesterday's quarrels or today's dispute. They are also about setting frameworks for tomorrow's contests. This may involve access to our vital lifelines like our information systems, energy grids, and water systems. At the same time, countries are grappling with how to harness new technologies while implementing effective guardrails. And we have to deal with what we call the regulation paradox. Regulate too early, and we risk stifling innovation. Regulate too late, and norms have become entrenched and too difficult to reverse. So where does that leave us? As conflict evolves, our responses must also adapt. Let me suggest three responses in our principles, partnerships, and politics. First, principles, institutions, and norms. We must both maintain and update the rules and norms that are critical to our security and progress. We must not think that we can do without principles, institutions, and norms. Second, partnerships. We need more and new networks of flexible, overlapping, issues-based partnerships to address the new challenges. We must not think that going alone can better address our insecurities. Third, domestic politics. Domestic confidence and cohesion are prerequisites for policy continuity, societal coherence, capability development, and in turn, international cooperation. We cannot manage international issues without managing domestic issues well, nor can we manage domestic issues well by ignoring international ones. Let me start with principles, institutions, and norms. The current system, our current system, is not perfect and needs to be refreshed and aligned with today's realities. But let us not throw the baby out with the bathwater, nor let the perfect be the enemy of the good. The alternative, a world with weak institutions and norms, where every issue and every relationship is viewed through a transactional lens, will leave us all worse off. More beggar thy neighbor policies makes beggars of us all. Heightened uncertainties erode business confidence, deter investments, and ultimately slow growth. All these then shrink the space for domestic politics and international collaboration, stifling growth further. This will soon become a negative spiral. For our nations and economies to thrive, we need stability, predictability, undergirded by rules and norms. Forgoing all these for short-term political gain would undermine our long-term collective security. The rules and norms are especially critical when they are grounded in international law. The UN Convention of the Law of the Sea, or UNCLOS, is one example. It provides clear and firm rules for our maritime activities, including the right of transit passage through critical straits used for international navigation. Keeping our sea lanes open is not just a matter of law, but of enlightened self-interest of all nations. Our survival, trade, and prosperity depend on it. Recent developments in the Straits of Hormuz remind us why such maritime rights matter. Should the right of transit passage be eroded, all countries that depend on maritime connectivity would be worse off. For the sake of global commerce, we must avoid a race to the bottom where states try to price each other out of access to such critical straits. And today, these waterways carry not just trade, but our critical pipelines for energy and data as well. It is in our own enlightened self and collective interest to keep them accessible, open, and secure. This is why Singapore works with Indonesia, Malaysia, and Thailand on the Malacca Straits Patrol. We recognize that freedom of navigation along the straits for trade, for data, and for energy cannot be secured by any single country alone. It requires practical cooperation from all stakeholders. This brings me to the second suggestion, the need for more and new overlapping networks of flexible and issue-based arrangements to complement multilateral cooperation. If international cooperation is a lattice, multilateral institutions are its pillars. They provide legitimacy and inclusiveness. But as new domains evolve rapidly, we cannot be held hostage by the lowest common denominator. We should instead develop flexible partnerships with like-minded countries, forming coalitions of the able and willing. These serve as the connecting beams of our cooperative lattice to bridge gaps, test ideas, pathfind in new and uncharted territories. And as our second speaker mentioned, some of these new networks must include not just countries, but also other stakeholders. With these networks, we can work towards building trust in domains such as cyber and AI. AI offers tremendous opportunities to strengthen national security, but no government wants an uncontrollable AI-enabled weapon system. This is why Singapore has worked with partners like the Netherlands and the Republic of Korea to convene global discussions on military AI governance. In the cyber domain, Singapore launched the ADMM Cyber Security and Information Center of Excellence in 2023. Singapore saw value in building a regional network that translates UN-level norms into practical regional cooperation. ACICE is leading an effort to implement the 11 UN norms on responsible state behavior in cyberspace for ASEAN member states. Beyond cyber and AI, Singapore sees an urgent need to establish guardrails to protect our critical underwater infrastructure. As Australian DPM Richard Miles noted yesterday, subsea cables and pipelines are critical infrastructure underpinning our global connectivity, and their vulnerability is a growing shared concern. These systems span jurisdictions and cannot be secured by any single state alone. This is why Singapore spearheaded the development of the guiding principles for underwater infrastructure defense exchanges, or GIDE, with like-minded partners. And we launched this yesterday, and we welcome more partners to join us. While we work with Brunei and Thailand to co-sponsor the 2025 ADMM concept paper on critical underwater infrastructure, or CUI, security, from a defense perspective, we saw a need to bring together like-minded partners from across different regions to tackle the global and transboundary challenge of CUI security. We are pleased that GIDE was launched yesterday with 17 countries from Europe, Southeast Asia, Oceania regions, and the Middle East. GIDE is a non-legally binding multilateral initiative that outlines shared principles for CUI security and highlights potential areas of cooperation for us to translate into real capability. The value of GIDE is not only in the principles themselves, but in the network it builds. Through GIDE, we hope to bring countries together around a shared vulnerability and develop common practices before they are tested in crisis. Let me turn to my final suggestion on politics. Trust abroad requires confidence at home. Emeritus Senior Minister Goh Chok Tong once described Singapore as a small speedboat in an open sea. This image still holds. We cannot control the sea, but we can certainly keep our boat seaworthy. A captain cannot steer the boat effectively if the crew is divided. If our society is anxious or distrustful, our leaders will have less room to negotiate abroad. Conversely, domestic confidence and cohesion creates space for governments to engage meaningfully and constructively and strike compromises and collaboration necessary for peace. Domestic stability and external collaboration form a double helix that can and must reinforce each other. In these rough seas, steering the boat is not an easy task. It may be tempting to enact simple, populist solutions to earn domestic short-term support. However, over time, such solutions erode trust, deepen divisions, and leave societies less resilient. True leadership demands the courage to speak difficult truths, the discipline to take a long-term view, and the conviction to act in the broader interests of our people. There is no shortcut for solving problems at home. Blaming others will not fix what is broken at home. Durable solutions require countries to address their own challenges directly using their economic, military, information levers. The stronger our trust at home, the more cohesive we are, the better place we are to work with others abroad. The stronger our capabilities, the more relevant we are, and the more credible and attractive a partner we can become. By pulling our own weight, we preserve agency to pursue our own interests and avoid the forced choice of having to pick sides that ultimately makes us irrelevant. Ladies and gentlemen, our challenges ahead are daunting. But I must say that every generation will have our own challenges cut out for us. But they also represent opportunities for us to strengthen cooperation between states. Our challenges will not define us. Our responses to our challenges will define us. We can either be paralyzed by the magnitude of our challenges and retreat into zero-sum competition, or we can choose a different path by refreshing the rules that matter, creating new norms for emerging domains, and sustaining practical cooperation. Amidst these changes, our goal remains the same: to build a better future for the next generation. Singapore will continue to do our part to contribute to global stability, and it is in this spirit of encouraging honest dialogue and practical cooperation that we host the SLD every year. Let us leave this gathering not just with a better understanding of our challenges, of each other's challenges, but with a renewed commitment to work together in addressing them. And before I end, I'd like to thank IISS, the staff of Shangri-La Hotel, our security forces and media friends for your hard work behind the scenes. Thank you. I wish you a safe journey home, and we look forward to hosting you once again next year. Thank you very much.
And we just heard from Singapore's Defense Minister Chan Chun Sing at the Shangri-La Dialogue, where he set out Singapore's approach to evolving security threats. His key message: security today depends not only on military strength, but also on rules, partnerships, and resilience at home. Mr. Chan wrapping up the three-day premier security defense dialogue here in Singapore, stressing the need to keep sea lanes open, pointing to the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea and the right of transit to pass. And he also cited the Strait of Malacca as an example of why freedom of navigation matters to Singapore, while warning that instability in critical waterways such as the Strait of Hormuz would affect all countries that depend on maritime connectivity. Mr. Chan also called for more flexible partnerships on emerging threats such as cyber, AI, and underwater infrastructure. And he also brought the issue back home, saying trust abroad must be matched by trust at home, with national cohesion now a key part of security policy. And thank you for watching our live coverage at the Shangri-La Dialogue 2026. That's it for Asia Now for this hour. But don't forget headlines anytime at CNA.Asia and CNA 93 Radio. Plus, we're on Facebook and YouTube.